at the moment of independence, which for different Francophone African countries happened around 1958 to 1960. Guinea, there was a vote. General de Gaulle went around to all of the Francophone countries in 1958 and gave all the countries a chance to vote country by country as to whether they wanted complete independence or to remain in a kind of a French Commonwealth status. At that time, Guinea was probably the richest Francophone West African country. As you may know, it has the biggest bauxite reserves in the world, which aluminum is made from, as well as a lot of other things, iron and so forth. It's agriculturally rich. Côte d'Ivoire didn't have the mining wealth, but it did have a lot of agricultural potential. And French planters had already been cultivating cocoa and coffee, some other crops, including pineapples. And to do that, they had brought in migrant labor from neighboring countries as well. So at that moment of the vote in 58, Guinea chose independence. None of the other Francophone African countries did. And as it turned out, they pretty much all became independent 2 years later in 1960. But by that point, France had already begun a policy of, let's say, making an example of African leaders that chose to defy them, and supporting and giving a lot of economic support to countries that played the, neo-colonial game, if I can call it that. And so, among other things, there were security pacts between France and countries like Côte d'Ivoire, so that if there was ever an attempt to overthrow the president in Côte d'Ivoire, France promised to defend that government. And in fact, the French had military bases, continue to have military bases in several Francophone African countries, including Côte d'Ivoire, Senegal, Chad. And so it's one of the important aspects of the post-colonial pact between France and its former colonies, which has ensured that France continues to have a very significant role to play in terms of, the policies, especially foreign policy. Right now, counterterrorism is important to France, but also the kind of the politics around agricultural exports like cocoa. So if we now come to the post 1960 period, Hofuet Boigny was very much one of the leaders who cooperated with France, and the French kind of flooded the country with economic support, diplomatic support, and even a lot of French civil servants who were working in the Ivoirian government as employees of the Ivoirian government. But they were simultaneously employees of the French government. And so for quite a while, this turned out to be a very successful deal for both the French and the Ivoirians. And Côte d'Ivoire went from being, let's say, an important second-rung producer of cocoa to being the world's top producer, producing about 40% of the world's cocoa, and surpassing Nigeria, Ghana, Brazil. And there are some technical aspects to how cocoa grows and what they call the cocoa frontier. I won't go into a lot of detail, but in short, cocoa grows very productively for about 30 to 40 years after you cut down the existing forest and plant cocoa trees. And then after that, the productivity goes way down. So there's a tendency for cocoa plantations to sort of migrate across the landscape. That's important because some of the countries like Ghana and Nigeria that began producing a lot of cocoa earlier in West Africa, their production kind of fell off, partly for political reasons, partly for reasons that have to do with the agronomy and the, the technical aspects of growing cocoa. At the same time, Côte d'Ivoire came up, they also produced a lot of coffee, and some of these other things like pineapples. So the country became quite rich, and a lot of ordinary farmers over the course of 10 or 20 years in the 60s and 70s also went from being pretty much subsistence level farmers to pretty rich planters. And the kind of the figure of an old Ivoirian man, you know, who maybe couldn't even read or write but was driving a Mercedes-Benz, became sort of the symbol of this form of success. And meanwhile, the French were pumping money into infrastructure, building very good roads, ports, things like this, and maintaining not a monopoly, but a lot of influence over how the cocoa flowed out. So let me bring in ethnicity and then try to show you how, you know, the political economic changes in the 80s and 90s actually brought ethnicity to the forefront. So Cote d'Ivoire, like almost every African country, has arbitrary frontiers. It's not like there was a nation existing that corresponded to Cote d'Ivoire before the French arrived to colonize the place. So they set their borders, and many of the ethnic groups that live in Cote d'Ivoire also live on the other side of the border in Liberia or Guinea or Burkina Faso or Mali or Ghana. And so to say that somebody is of an ethnicity that is authentically or historically Ivoirian is almost an oxymoron, right? It's a contradiction in terms, in the sense that nobody was Ivoirian just 130, 140 years ago. It's a historical fiction. But even more than that, in Cote d'Ivoire, there's a particularly strange history, because for a while, when the French were interested in bringing the, you know, what you call in French the main d'oeuvre, the workers from the northern neighbors of what is now Cote d'Ivoire, they actually expanded the borders of Cote d'Ivoire to include about a third of what today is Burkina Faso. So for a period of about 30 years, the borders between Cote d'Ivoire and Burkina Faso were completely different. And that was just a colonial administrative fix to facilitate drawing workers from the relatively poor north, where it was the soil was not very rich and the rainfall was not plentiful, and sort of facilitate their being brought down toward the southern cocoa and coffee belt to work on these plantations. So this is something that began under colonization, and Cote d'Ivoire, even if that had not happened, has a mix of people who are historically Muslim, going back in some cases many hundreds of years, and people who converted from African religions to mostly Catholicism and more recently to kind of Pentecostalist Protestant Christianity. And so those differences existed even within the current borders of Cote d'Ivoire. But what happened in a lot of ways is that the areas that were producing most of the cocoa ended up with the majority of the population being people who came from either the northern part of Cote d'Ivoire or the neighboring countries. So the people who had been born and whose parents and grandparents had been born in these cocoa growing areas in the southern half of the country, in some cases became the minority within their own villages and regions. All of this was fine when everybody was making money. The owners of the plantations were making a lot of money. The state was making a tremendous amount of money, to the point where French politicians began coming to Abidjan to receive money from Hofwe Boigny, the president of Cote d'Ivoire, to fund their own political elections in France, suggesting that in some ways there was more money, you know, floating around in Cote d'Ivoire than in France itself. And the workers who were coming from the north were not making a lot of money, but they were making more money than they could make back home. And so they were able to send money home. They were able to send their kids to school back in the north of Cote d'Ivoire or in Burkina Faso or Mali or Guinea, and build houses and all of those things. Where the tensions really began was in the middle of the 1980s, during the period of what was called the Cocoa War. Hofe Boigny decided that the world price for cocoa was too low, and both the Ivoirian state and the Ivoirian cocoa farmers were not getting their due share of the cocoa prices. And so he held Ivoirian cocoa off of the world market for 2 years, trying to force the major agribusiness companies that bought the cocoa to raise their buying price. And long story short, he failed, and Cote d'Ivoire was took a very big economic hit at that moment. The world cocoa agribusiness companies began seeking other countries to begin growing more cocoa to offer alternatives to Cote d'Ivoire, and both the French government and these businesses essentially combined forces to crush, you know, what was perceived as the the rebellion by this post-colonial government. From that point onward, the cocoa economy, and it was not only for that reason, but that was kind of the beginning of the end of the golden years. And the cocoa economy, really up until the present, has diminished in importance and has produced less wealth for people in Cote d'Ivoire. And as that has happened, very much as in post-industrial areas in England leading up to the Brexit vote, or in the U.S. leading up to the election of, Donald Trump, or in many other places in EU countries and even other parts of the world, the growth of xenophobia and the attention to who is truly a citizen, who is truly indigenous or native or an owner of the land, all of those things started taking on increased significance. And this is where the attention to Ouattara's nationality comes into play. At one point, he held a Burkinabe passport because it helped him get a scholarship. And he worked as a Burkinabe representative in international organizations, and so he has family from both sides, the Ivoirian side and the Burkina Faso side. But just as, for instance, Bedié, the former president, has family with links on both sides of the Ghana-Cote d'Ivoire border. So, you know, again, I would emphasize the sort of arbitrary nature of these borders. And especially when you include the fact that Cote d'Ivoire's borders actually included parts of Burkina Faso for a while, it's almost meaningless to make that distinction. It's a kind of, well, as you can see in European politics, whether you're talking about Hungary or the UK or wherever, when people start talking about these kinds of things, historical identity, citizenship, access to certain kinds of goods that the state can provide, it's often a situation where you get very different versions of history, right? And they are instrumentalized so as to make a certain kind of argument about politics in the present and sort of dragging your version of history into the argument to try to support what is really an argument about how should the pie be divided up amongst people right now. And of course, when it's a shrinking pie, when the pie is expanding, these kinds of arguments tend to be rather quiet. But when it's a shrinking pie, this is where politicians who are competing for public office can then recruit large portions of the population to also feel like they are being cheated and they have to support the nativist or the, you know, the ethno-nationalist candidate. So, you're from Slovenia. So, you know, Hofe Boigny is sort of the Tito of Cote d'Ivoire, you could say. I think you could probably argue in ex-Yugoslavia as in Cote d'Ivoire, even if Hofep-Wanyi is seen as the guy who could juggle all the different ethnic claims and kind of keep people more or less satisfied, he is also the person who sowed the seeds of the later collapse of the country. And what I mean by that is, number one, you know, he was president for 33 years. He was president for life. He died in office, and everything always had to revolve around him. And so by the Constitution, the president of the National Assembly, who was Henri Konan Bedier, was the person designated to take over if the president should die in office. Alassane Ouattara was the prime minister and was not the person designated to take over. But because the politics of the PDCI party, which Hofep-Wanyi, Bedié, and Ouattara, all three of them were members of the PDCI, because the politics were so personalized, Ouattara felt that as a political personality, he could stake a claim to taking over when Hofep died, rather than Bedié, rather than following the constitution. And it was at that moment that Bedié prevailed. He was, you know, in the right as far as the constitution went. But his qualities as a leader were very limited. And the other thing that had happened during the later years of Hofep, let's say from the mid 80s until his death in 93, is that, as you say, corruption became much, much worse. And again, it's worth emphasizing, there was always money going missing in the old days, but also the economy was growing at an extremely fast rate. You could use the you know, the analogy of China. You know, when the World Bank says you have to get rid of corruption for an economy to grow, a lot of countries in the global south say, well, what about China, right? There's a lot of corruption, and it's the fastest growing economy in the world. At a certain point in an economy's history, then, you know, the corruption can become a drag and a real problem. But at another point in its, you know, in its history, it might not be a problem at all. So, you know, Hofep-Wanyi let this sort of flourish among all the people underneath him. It was one of the ways that he kept people happy and that he balanced all of the different claims that different regions were making. But when the money began to dry up, suddenly the elite still wanted their benefits that were coming from, you know, illegal or illicit means, but there wasn't much left over afterwards for the rest of the population. So this was the period, you know, in the 90s when Bedié did not have a lot of legitimacy. He was not the father of independence. He didn't have the kind of charisma that Hofep had. And so the political game turned to disqualifying your opponents more than making a positive case for why you should be the leader of the country. And so this is the moment when Ouattara's nationality came into question, and because he was the main opponent from the opposition, Bedié tried, you know, using this concept of Ivoirite, which just means Ivoirianness. He got a few historians and political scientists at the universities to sort of cook up, and philosophers even, to cook up a kind of, you know, philosophy of what Ivoirianness meant. I don't find it very convincing. I'm not sure that any other academics do. But be that as it may, you know, it was used to put a stamp of kind of quasi-intellectual seriousness on what was really an attempt to just take Ouattara and push him to one side and get him out of the political game. At that time, it's worth saying that Laurent Gbagbo, who was a history professor, said that this was totally illegitimate, and it was, he gave basically the version that I've just given you, that it was just a politically motivated attempt to get Ouattara out of politics. And so Gbagbo actually was on the same side as Ouattara. After the coup in 1999, you know, the short version is that the general who headed the coup tried to just stay in power, and tried to eliminate everybody from the kind of sham election except for Laurent Gbagbo, because he assumed that Gbagbo, who had been a minor opposition figure until that point, couldn't possibly get enough votes to win. As it turned out, Ivoirians were really angry at what General Gay was his name, what General Gay was trying to do, and they voted for Gbagbo. So Gbagbo, in that two-man election, was elected president. At that moment, all of the others, including Bedier, Ouattara, and others, were saying, you've got to have a new legitimate election where everybody is included. But Gbagbo said no. And suddenly Gbagbo then picked up this issue of Ouattara being a foreigner, not being a legitimate political contestant in Ivoirian politics. And so then Gbagbo flipped from being somebody who was, you know, a historian and talking about the historical realities of the country to a politician who was interested also in pushing his opponents out of the picture. And that's really, you know, the situation in which the 2002 attempted coup took place, and then the coup was unsuccessful, but the coup fighters were able to control the northern half of the country. And so then you had a situation from 2002 to 2011 where the country was like Cyprus. It was basically split in two with a line patrolled by French, mostly French, some UN soldiers, called the Zone de Confiance, which was a kind of buffer zone between the two. So from that point, for 9 years, Cote d'Ivoire was basically two separate countries being ruled from separate capitals by separate governments, the rebel government and the Gbagbo government in the south. When that election took place, you will see a lot of journalistic versions of this, which portray Cote d'Ivoire as having a two-way conflict between north and south, between Muslims in the north and Christians in the south. Yeah, and that's never really been the whole story. I mean, that's, you know, if you only have a few paragraphs to describe a complex situation, this is what you end up with. But you always had at least three groups in play at once, from independence until today. And the heartland of Hofwepwanyi and Bedier's party, the PDCI, is the eastern and central part of the country, which is culturally very much linked to Ghana, to the Asante cultural sort of zone. And then you have the north, where most people are Muslim, although there are more Muslims living in the south of Cote d'Ivoire than in the north, just because the south has higher population density and northerners or Muslims have come to the south over many, many generations. And then you have this, central western and southwestern zone, which is another big ethnic group, and this is the area that Gbagbo came from. What happened in the 2010 elections is that Ouattara, who was in some ways representing the north, but also the many, many Muslims living in the southern part of the country and in Abidjan, the economic capital, made a common cause with the PDCI and the political barons, as they're called, the power brokers, from the east, from this area where Hofwepwanyi and Bedier came from. They agreed that whichever candidate made it to the second round of the elections would have the support of the other group. So Ouattara was the one who was going up against Gbagbo in the second round of the elections. And so the PDCI, Bedier's party, promised their support. And a lot of people were really sick of Gbagbo's government. Gbagbo's supporters would not see it that way. But I think that in truth, there was a majority electoral coalition there between the East, the North, and people from the East and the North who were resident in Abidjan and the area around that. And so Ouattara was elected in a free and fair election in 2010, but Gbagbo refused to leave office. And long story short, there was fighting, and the rebel group, the Force Nouvelle, pushed their way southward. There were massacres and killings perpetrated by both sides. I think most of the people who have looked in detail at them, and I have not, but most people have weighed in that the majority of those killed were killed by people who supported President Gbagbo. But again, his supporters would contest and disagree with that. But long story short, the Force Nouvelle fighters came all the way down into Abidjan. There was fighting in the streets of Abidjan. And finally, Laurent Gbagbo and his wife and his closest circle were in a bunker underneath the presidential residence. And it was the Force Nouvelle, with assistance from French troops, that went in and forcibly pulled him out. And the fact that the French soldiers were involved in that very delicate, politically sensitive moment is something that is still completely unacceptable and has never been digested or accepted by a lot of Ivoirians, and not just the ones who were ardent supporters of Gbagbo, but others who just feel like the French should not have been involved in that way in the internal affairs of the country. So it kind of it did a lot to undercut the legitimacy of Ouattara, who, in as everything that I've ever seen, indicates to me that he really did win the election, but his legitimacy was kind of undercut right from the beginning by the involvement of the French, especially because Gbagbo had always portrayed himself as the one who was fighting French neo-colonial interference in the country. So yeah, that in 2011, Ouattara is basically installed as president, and now he's just been elected in a very how shall I call it? A very questionable circumstance, which goes against the Ivoirian constitution. The Ivoirian constitution has been changed and, let's say, manipulated at several points along the way, including to introduce Article 35, which is the article that was essentially written specifically to exclude Alassane Ouattara from running for president. I mean, it was an article added to the Constitution specifically to bar one person in the entire country from running. In principle, it could apply to other people, but that was the motivation, and that was what happened. There's a similar article in the Burmese or the Myanmar Constitution, which was written to bar Aung San Suu Kyi from ever becoming president. So, it raises questions about, is the Constitution this sacred document, or is it actually something that people use as a very crude political tool to achieve some political ends in the moment? And then what happens to these kinds of articles, once that person has left the political scene? Does it remain in, or does it get taken out? And of course, the laws of countries all over the world have these kind of residues from prior, contentious moments in the country's history that people have generally just forgotten about. So that makes me a little bit skeptical of some of the talk about constitutionalism, which treats the Constitution as this sort of sacred document that has to be respected in every way. That said, I think most people can agree that the spirit of the Constitution prohibited Alassane Ouattara from running again this time. He seemed to agree with that up until August. And so, I mean, if the exact wording of the Constitution could be used to argue in both directions for and against his candidacy, I don't know. I'm not a lawyer, but I do think that the spirit of the Constitution was to enforce term limits, and he has gone against that, which is why, many Ivoirians basically, they express their displeasure by not voting. One of the things that we've seen in the last decade or so, and I work in Guinea too, the exact same thing is happening in Guinea. People who were the historic opponents of longtime autocratic leaders finally get into power. And what we find is that in many cases, rather than saying, the 30 years that I spent being beaten up, thrown in jail, living in exile, and insisting that having somebody be president for life was terrible for the country, now I'm going to go back on all of that and I'm going to try to be president for life. What happened in especially Francophone countries in terms of, multi-party democracy was simply the end of the Cold War. And, instead of supporting somebody like Mobutu, who said he would fight communists and then just allowing him to do whatever he pleased, suddenly, this was François Mitterrand, just basically, they have a meeting in France of all the Francophone African leaders every year. And this conference at La Baule in France was very famous because he basically said the rules of the game have changed. The Berlin Wall is down, and the rules have changed. You now have to have multi-party democracy.